The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we uncover the latest in the story of Haystack, the cloaking program distributed to Iranian web users during the violent protests in the aftermath of that country's election. It's since been found to have placed its users in danger rather than protecting them from the authorities. We look at the latest hacker actions taken against the Recording Industries Associations of America and the Motion Picture Association of America, causing their services to go down. And we discuss the waning influence of email as users turn to different tools to communicate more effectively with one another. Are priority mail services the answer, or is a whole new communication paradigm in order? We speak with one developer who's working to help us manage our inboxes of the future. Joining me to discuss these stories and more are digital media correspondent Jemima Kish and technology editor Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both. And my first question, Charles, is to you. Have you ever actually achieved inbox zero?
I think when I've set up a new email account, I mean, I know you looked over my shoulder actually last week when we were at the Nokia World Show, and you nearly had a fit at the number of unread emails I had, because there pretty much wasn't room for it to say how many unread emails I had.
Honestly, my heart is palpitating just thinking. My throat is constricting.
I'm so torn.
In the thousands.
I'm so torn because the logical side of my brain says, do you know what? You really don't need to have read all these emails, but there's something in me that compels me to process them all. Must process every email.
And how many do you have in your inbox that are unread?
I'm unread none, but it's acting on them and replying to them.
Oh, honestly.
So probably like we're quite good at the moment, about 40. On an amazing day, it'd be under 10. It's never been zero since
I started.
Look, I
think this is like going to a library and saying, oh, there's lots of books here, I'm going to read them all. Yeah, it's just not. You're going to choose the best.
People demand your attention. They need, they want, they desire.
It's
not even just like, quit.
For some people, it's rude not to reply, and I really do try.
Well, we'll talk about this in a little bit, and I hope that my heart stops palpitating by that point. Keep listening for the next 30 minutes to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. We start with this week's news. First, there's been widespread concern that a piece of software called Haystack, released to Iranian citizens in the wake of the violence in the 2009 election that claimed to be anti-censorship by making its users anonymous, actually made its users more vulnerable. It's been claimed that the code actually gave away key information about its users, thus putting them in greater danger from the authorities than using an unencrypted web. The U.S. government gave its seal of approval to the software created by a virtual team of Austin Heap and Daniel Coliscone, and their pair received plaudits from many organizations, including this podcast and The Guardian. This is no mere hiccup in the history of internet security. Web commentator and lecturer Evgeny Muratsov, who's been critical about Haystack since the outset, commented on a recent blog entry, "Haystack is the internet's equivalent of the Bay of Pigs invasion. It's the epitome of everything that's wrong with Washington's push to promote internet freedom without thinking through the consequences and the risks involved." Charles, fill us in. What's the latest on this story?
I'll just go back very slightly and say that I think that Evgeny Morozov is overplaying it by saying it's the equivalent of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which is when Kennedy tried to invade Cuba. A lot of soldiers died, and it was clearly a completely bonkers thing for the US government to do at that time. This is slightly more nuanced. So with Haystack, the idea was Haystack was a sort of client-server piece of software which would let people who installed it on their computers be able to put out messages which would look like innocent web traffic, perhaps sending some pictures and stuff, but actually they'd be able to communicate via Haystack's server, which would be in a different country, and send important messages to people about, say, the situation as it was going on. What turns out to be the case is that the software had various flaws which would have let other people, such as if you imagine a situation where the Iranian authorities got hold of a copy or were using a copy to trace back and get a unique fingerprint of someone's computer And if they then captured that computer, then they could match up the two and say, okay, you are the person who has been doing these things. So the software has been withdrawn from use, although there are still claims that there may be copies out there which are still being used by some people. The implication is it's actually testers in the West who are the people using it, because Evgeny Morozov managed to get a copy of the software that was circulating in the wild and get it sort of torn down or tested by some people who suggested that it was just very bad. Daniel Colasconi sent a long mea culpa to a mailing list in which he said that he had left lots of diagnostic stuff inside the software that would have been sending out information that he shouldn't have left in. Austin Heapers sort of made sort of noises, I guess you'd call it, saying that he sort of regrets it all. I did contact him trying to get a comment. He emailed me back and said, I'll answer within 24 hours, but that was about a week ago, and since then I've heard nothing.
Well, we also tried to contact Austin as well, and he said that he would chat, but off the record. And unfortunately, we weren't able to connect in the time before the program. Now, it is interesting that the hype that seems to have surrounded Haystack. I mean, it was picked up by credible news organizations. What do you think it says about this hype cycle?
Well, if you flash back to the period, you know, the time when it happened, you're talking about the Iranian elections, where there was enormous dispute within the country about whether they had been rigged or not. And President Obama had to find some sort of way of suggesting that people should be allowed to express themselves while not sort of upsetting the whole realpolitik with Iran, which is very, very sensitive because of its nuclear ambitions. So it's much simpler if, for example, some software comes forward from someone who says, hey, this would let people in Iran who are, you know, not happy with the regime speak their minds. You know, the U.S. State Department fast-tracked an export a license for it because it uses encryption. That's why it had to get a license from the State Department. And this is where Evgeny Morozov is very critical about it. He's saying, you know, the State Department should have looked into it. They should have decided whether or not it was safe. I think that's overplaying it a bit. I mean, his argument is that the U.S. State Department should have looked into the software. His argument actually is the Guardian should have looked at the software, that we should have tested it out in great detail, which again I think is slightly overdone. You know, to some extent, we have to take many things on face value. Though what I've subsequently heard from one Iranian who has good contacts inside the country is that this stuff was Mac only. There's hardly anyone in Iran who uses a Mac. So,
yeah,
you know,
a dozen people.
Yeah. So the number of people who might be at risk is actually minimal. It would be simpler for the Iranian government if they really minded like that, just to round up all the Mac users and interview them.
The point is that this was a fantastic idea, but it just didn't quite deliver, did it? And perhaps it was the fault of us in the media and in the West for, you know, making it sound like the ideal solution to something, and it clearly wasn't robust enough to do that.
The thing was, it would have been a great idea, and it would have satisfied so many people who wanted it to be so, that you know, dissatisfied Iranians would have been able to communicate what was going on inside their country.
But would it have been mainstream enough to let them do that?
That's really hard to say. Although it's interesting that earlier this week there was a conference where some software was shown, which has been developed by some American professors, which would use steganography, which is hiding information in things like pictures, which would let people upload stuff to Flickr or TwitPic, and you could embed the information in there. So the sort of idea of people being able to communicate from within Iran and other places isn't dead. It's simply this instance of it which is dead. But I don't think this is a Bay of Pigs by any means for the technology industry.
Well, also in this week's news, hundreds of thousands of members of the 4chan online community organized a denial of service attack on the RIAA and the MPAA websites in protest of their litigious attitudes towards websites that promote file sharing of copyrighted materials. Users of the infamous image board and other sympathizers directed enormous amounts of internet traffic to MPAA.com and RIAA.com, overburdening the servers and knocking out access to the sites. And in fact, the MPAA site was down for 18 hours, which is impressive. Now, Charles, how often do these kinds of attacks occur? They're not that infrequent, are they?
Oh, DDoS attacks happen all the time. They were very common about 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. They were used against gambling websites a lot, because you would get sort of Eastern European gangs who would hire a botnet, because DDoS is generally carried out via a botnet, and they would attack a site and say, we're going to attack your site the next time that there's a big event which you want to have a lot of money from gambling from. Basically, it was just straightforward extortion. It's something which has moved on to other sites. It's, you know, DDoS goes on a fair amount, and it's usually sort of random. It's a bit like sort of internet weather, except it's directed.
I love that idea of these sort of these cloud formations, these sort of weather formations just moving around. In fact, in many ways, testing the robustness of the atmosphere, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's the closest thing, I guess, you could say to internet weather that we have.
Wasn't it retaliation for an attack that 4chan said the industry had made on Pirate Bay?
It was actually specifically targeting another website, and that website went down very quickly, and so and so the members decided that they would go for a bigger fish.
But the MPAA and RIAA's beautifully named sites are kind of like brochures online, aren't they? They're not really
Like stamping on their brochure in the street. It's that's going to make a big difference.
That's exactly what it's like.
No, well, it's not exactly torching a record store.
No. Yeah.
Do you think that there will be any comeuppance for this, Jemima?
You know, is the Record Industry Association going to start court proceedings against them for, you know, initiating it? How are they going to track down?
You have the proof that you have to prove that actually it was the people who read it on 4chan who did it, and proving quite where a DDoS attack comes from is one of those things that is a very high skill level, and it's probably not worth a try.
It's not worth a trophy trial as well. I mean, what are they going to do?
There'll be a fabulous irony in the RIAA being attacked for being too litigious and then being litigious about being attacked.
Finally, this week, the open source social network Diaspora opened its code and launched its first iteration, prompting some to suggest that it's on its way to become the Facebook killer. The network, which its developers caution is only in its first release, will allow members control over the service because of its open source methodology, like operating system Ubuntu, the Linux version of Windows or Mac OS, or Firefox, Mozilla's open source browser. Diaspora will allow the community of developers to create options for everything from privacy to how connection information is managed in a very user-centered and personalized way. Now, Jemima, what else do we know about this service?
Not that much at the moment. I doubt it will present any serious threat to Facebook. Although, interestingly, Zuckerberg has invested in it himself and has also said in the past that their biggest threat will come from an unknown startup. That said, I think there's been so much interest around what Diaspora is doing. It's about the concept rather than the product, because there isn't really a product yet. And I think it's going to be very hard for them to meet the level of expectation that's been generated by the idea of their project.
What is it that people think it will do that Facebook can't? What do you think people think it will solve that is problematic with Facebook?
It's this sweet spot of data ownership and control over your own data. So effectively, you have it will be in the form of a program that you would download onto your machine, and that would contain all of your status updates, your photos, your videos, all of those social transactions, and then you would decide how those are farmed out to the sites that you use. And the way that that is structured is being discussed, I think, and how that's going to look and how the user interface is going to look is no small challenge, because these are things that sites like Facebook have some of the best developers in the world trying to tackle. So it's a massive problem.
And Charles, why do you think an open source social network would succeed?
I'm not sure I do think it would, because part of the problem is with open source projects that you tend not to be able to get people to focus on the right elements of it. So people will focus really hard on little bits of the code, but they won't think about the user experience. And getting good user experience designers is the sort of thing which takes a long time to do, and getting the user experience right is very hard. So, Facebook is always going to have a lead on them in that respect.
I think the interesting thing to watch are the next points on their roadmap, which are developing an API, among other things, but also Facebook integration. If they can nail that, if they don't need people to establish, to set up their own social network again, which is a huge investment of time and stuff, if they can get people to somehow pull their data from Facebook and then integrate with their service so you can have more control over that data, they could be onto something.
Well, stay tuned to these stories on our website, guardian.co.uk/technology, and get the latest headlines and developments as they arise.
Now, finally, here's a heads up for our program next week. The latest guest in our Startup Surgery series is corporate finance specialist Simon Carmichael of Torch Partners. So whether you're a startup who's already raised that first crucial round, whether you have a recognized VC on board and you dream of being the next Facebook, or whether you're a grand idea that just needs the right connections, Carmichael has a wealth of experience in refining your proposition to take your business to the next level. Jemima, that was beautifully written. So post your questions to the or problems, in fact, to the Tech Weekly blog, and we'll put all your questions to Simon during the program. The deadline is Thursday, the 23rd of September. And Jemima, yes, you'd like to say
something?
Well,
I was just going to say, I think it might actually be on the PDA blog.
It is on the PDA blog, but we can divide and conquer.
Okay, absolutely. Or you can tweet me. I'm at Jemima Kish.
Email is dead. There, I've said it. Well, it's certainly dead to me. My inbox is cluttered. It gives me a migraine just thinking about the unanswered demands of my attention, as I think I made perfectly clear earlier in this podcast. Inbox zero is some kind of myth. It can't actually happen. No. And as this scenario plays out, increasingly often in our modern connected world, new services like Gmail's Priority Inbox service or Zopni come along, promising us that we can organize our communications in an effective way. But can we really? And increasingly, my attention is drawn away from my mail.app to places like Facebook or Twitter, where communication comes from those people I want to talk with, not from some spammer with poor spelling and an audacious interest in my bank account details. We've asked Jeff Bonifiorte to join us in the studio to talk about Zopni. Welcome. Thank you very much for coming in.
Great to be here.
And how did I do in your surname?
Fantastic. That's the surname I've always wanted.
That's the one. Mamma mia. I'd like to say I have Italian roots, but that's no, right. It's purely Polish. But before you tell us about Zopni, please do enlighten me. Why is email not dead?
Well, by your definition of just simply being overloaded, I suspect it is dead. It's not that we're having less and less email every year. No matter what, we seem to get more and more. And you would think with Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and the rise of the social networks that would actually sort of reduce their inbox because people would be getting us by other channels. It's just simply increasing the amount of communication we're getting. So it's just getting more and more and more. So we have said, don't fight that battle. Like, don't try to fight the volume battle at all. Just arm yourself with much better tools, and at least you can manage the process better. So I feel better 3 years after working at Zopni. I feel more in control than I did 3 years prior to that. It doesn't mean my entire digital life is in order, and it's not really the aim of Zopni, is to provide you sort of perfect peace of mind. But, you know, there is an analogy that I think our users would understand and that the listeners will understand, which is that prior to Google in 96, 97, 98, the internet was getting bigger and bigger. We passed 100 million web pages. Almost all the search engines basically fell apart at 100 million pages. It was very common, in fact, to make a search request and scroll 10 pages through, right, to find that one. And so bookmarking was like a big deal. Everyone had bookmarks and hundreds and thousands of bookmarks. Google came onto the scene in 98-ish, and many of us started using it in 99 and 2000. Bookmarks basically disappeared. And so once the internet now has over a trillion web pages, we have a great search engine. Even Yahoo and Bing are quite able search engines. I'm a former Yahoo employee, so I have to throw it in there. So quite able search engines. And because the tools themselves are so much better, in fact, managing a trillion web pages feels more simple than it did managing 100 million. Basically, the same is true for your inbox and will be true in the future for social networks, which is the tools will get much smarter. As a result, we just won't have as much. I'm going to use some of my favorite technical terms. The cognitive load associated with recall will go down, meaning the amount of effort our brain puts into even fearing the recall of something will go down to such a limit that it won't be so much anxiety associated with looking at your inbox and seeing, you know, 2,000 unread messages.
Oh, God. No, honestly, you're sending me back to that fever pitch of horror.
Only 2,000?
Oh, yes, yeah. Charles.
Have you seen recent Twitter that people do? They say, I'm declaring inbox bankruptcy, right? That means I give up. So if you've emailed me in the last 6 months, you'll get nothing from me. I'm starting from zero.
Yep,
I've
done that.
People also say they're going, Periscope down because they've got something to concentrate on. And you can't do that with email because people can just keep bombarding you.
No, you can leave an autoresponder that says, I'm going away for a fortnight. When
you
I come back,
get control, the email.
Yeah, control, alt, delete. Or not control, alt, control, A, delete.
You guys are fighting the wrong battle.
Okay, tell us how it should
be. I really think that the inbox is the ultimate dumping ground, and it should be thought of that way to a certain extent, which is We don't just get one-to-one communication. If it were just simply that, it would actually be semi-manageable because we talked to fewer people, we'd get fewer emails. But in fact, we get emails from Amazon and we get emails from eBay and from Twitter and from Facebook that are alerting us. So the social web and the e-commerce sites, they're trying to drag us back to their sites. They use email as their way. We as users actually benefit a little bit from having all of our transactions from Amazon or in our inbox. They're ours. They're not residing on Amazon. So that's somewhat helpful if you make a trip, right? You have all your itineraries come to you in your inbox. We also have these. So those are fit under that do not reply, right? You see a lot of the email says do not reply at eBay or something. So that's it's an archive of all these transactions, which I think is beneficial for us to have. You don't necessarily have to read it, but when it's time to find it, it's helpful if you can do it. The other types of emails that we get are these group emails, which is less a one-to-one. It's not so much you with another person. It's you with something. You with a company, you with a group of people or a list. Depending, you know, if you work in a large company, you might be on 10 of these lists. They can generate 100 emails each a day. You know, that's one that can be quite... But again, the concept that somehow we should not see the message. You know, sometimes I see companies that say, well, help your employees learn how to not send email. I'm like, oh, this sounds like a recipe for disaster. Like, we'll communicate less internally and somehow magically it'll all work out. So again, I think if the tools get smarter, I heard a CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, speak last week, and he said, this is such a Google statement, by the way. I love it for its impersonalness, but he said, if humans would just use computers for what they do, which is they're so good at remembering things, and humans are notoriously terrible. In fact, even just remembering a memory, we tend to alter the memory a little bit each time. Computers don't do this. They're quite good at just storing data forever. We should just let them do it and we can go back to doing what we want to do, spend time with our kids or our friends. And so Zobni definitely subscribes to that concept, which is let the computer handle it and you can go back to dealing with the one-to-one relationships.
Well, here's a very specific question. I was at a House of Commons briefing. It was supposed to be ostensibly about the digital election and how the election in this country was going to be defined by social networks and participation, and isn't it fantastic? And pretty much within 3.5 seconds, the peers, the MPs, the people who were in the room who were supposed to be hearing about social networks started complaining about their inboxes. They started complaining about the fact that people demanded their attention, but these...
I love the British Parliament for that. Yeah. Just grumpy, like, rrr.
But they couldn't, they're literally unable to not pay attention to it because they're public representatives. And in the same way, you know, we have people who demand our attention as people in the public eye. So how do we cope with the fact that we've got strangers who are emailing us and we're not on lists or, you know, that don't subscribe to the do not reply?
Yeah, definitely. So, well, there are a few things happening, which is that humans have been so good at evolving in this world around all the things that are happening to us. And we're getting a little bit to the point where we're evolving a little bit slower now than the technology. The technology is sort of evolving ahead of us. So even things like what are the social mores associated with reply time and all these things. So 10 years ago, maybe you're getting 10 or 15 emails a day. In fact, I remember, you know, AOL made their name with the You've Got Mail call. Can you imagine if that were still in progress today? It would just be you. We'd be going,
oh, it's not.
Shut it up. I know.
Jeff, what is the basic thing that Zobni does? I mean, I have to say, I use Apple's mail program.
Careful,
which has...
You're going to hurt my feelings, so back away slowly.
But that offers you what it calls smart filters, so you can say, okay, show me a view of my inbox, which doesn't have the Amazon emails, which doesn't have the PayPal emails, which you know, doesn't have all the mail things, blah, 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 blah. Show me all the things that are not those things.
Yeah. Those tools are all junk. So
what is it that Zobni does that's different? Because, I mean, I can see that for myself, what I'd really like would be sort of like a human secretary, a Bayesian system, for example, which says, okay, well, these things in the past have been good things. These have been things that have been read and wanted and so on.
This is, Priority Inbox, the Google recent announcement, actually, I think, has some work in it from a former Zobni employee. But in general, the things that Zobni does is within your inbox exist these relationships. So the average inbox has about 4,000 people in it. These are people that are on the to line, the CC line, the from line. Even people are in the body, right? I might refer to someone and say, oh, make sure you contact Jill. Zobni finds all 4,000 people. And then we find the affiliations of that person, typically the company there where they work. We do analysis on the people. We rank those people. We come up with what we call a relationship relevance. So relationship relevance is very akin to the PageRank from Google, which is that you don't just use sort of raw statistical data to figure out what's good, or you don't just look at the words. You have to look at the authority of the page, who else links to it, etc. Zobny does the same thing. When you understand who these 4,000 people are, that relationship relevance, email search is trivial. You type in M-A-T-T, it's not going to find Matt Adams, the first Matt listed alphabetically, and it's not going to find the first document with a subject line that says Matt, 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 Matt. In fact, it finds the most popular Matt for you, and it may even find the most popular Matt circumstantially, meaning how does that Matt relate to the email you're looking at or something like that. So when you have relationship relevance, it makes most of the things you do in your inbox pretty simple. It's like a crazy magic trick. When I show people, just I can find an attachment in 2 seconds, and they'll say, that's not possible.
But so Zobny is working on the weaknesses of Outlook or Outlook Express,
which didn't have all the
ability to search through it. Though I suspect that what the other three of us are talking about is, how the hell do I make it so that the emails that I see, the emails that are presented to me, are actually the ones that I want to deal with, not how do I search for the thing that I read some time ago.
In fact, that problem is solved by the priority inbox from Gmail. We find our users less likely to want their inbox reprioritized. Basically, here's the problem with email. It's inefficient, but it's efficient because users have become so used to the inefficiencies. So,
what's sort of like the typewriter?
The
keys are meant to
QWERTY
slow down.
Keyboard is identical. That's exactly true. So if you change behavior, it's usually a losing battle. So the problem with priority inbox is, if you try to change the user behavior, it's quite difficult. If Google makes a mistake, even 2% of the time on that priority inbox, remember the old spam filters that were about 95% accurate, and how embarrassing it was when your boss would email and you'd miss it because it was junk mail? Today, spam filters must be at least 99% plus accurate for a user to accept it. Same is true for the tools you build for the inbox. Inbox is a priority one system. It's being used for mission critical everything in your life, even if it's a personal inbox. So almost all the tools you have in there is really have to be 99% plus accurate. We'll see how priority inbox does, but I'm suspicious that users are less likely to change their behavior. Sorry.
I don't know if email really is mission critical anymore. I mean,
it's possible.
The thing about email is that we've been conditioned by letter writing, and email carries on those conditions. So that's why there's such an emotional burden with them, because we grew up thinking that we have to reply to letters. There's still the convention of saying dear, sir, madam. There's still the signatures. That's a massive part of the problem. If you think about Twitter and that kind of ambient communication, when you've been on holiday for a week, unless you're really sad, you don't sit down and read tweets from the last week.
It's true.
Could,
so you know,
couldn't we learn from that?
Well, I think Americans are more rude than Europeans in general.
I disagree. So, I think Americans are more polite.
I have proof that we're more rude. I used to do this business where we'd send out business proposals, and the Europeans would respond like 3 times as often as the Americans. The Americans would just throw it in the trash can, and the Europeans always felt compelled to even write back, thank you for your offer. We've decided not to pursue that.
Maybe we're just better at letters.
I just thought it was charming. Yeah, but so I agree that so if you think of this, recently somebody said about Twitter, it's just a new news feed, which is less and less it's about communication, and more it's about an interesting filter on what's happening on the internet. So it's broadening. We're going deeper and deeper into the internet because we have social filtering going on from our thousands of people that we might be following. Email just serves a different purpose. It's like you don't want your Amazon receipt sent to you. You don't want your itinerary sent to you in your Twitter feed. That would be awkward. So email has an instantaneousness to it, but it also has this, it's an archive that's going on and on and on forever. Twitter will only allow you to search 2 days. I mean, it's not like you can go back at all. And maybe that's wonderful. You know, maybe we'll learn to live right in the present, just as we've all been told we're supposed to. But
so what is the future then of Zobny? What's the release schedule, and what can we expect to see from it?
Well, we've been in Outlook historically, because Outlook is the crappiest of all email clients. So it was like it's what we call fertile.
I don't know. Have you used Lotus Notes?
Oh, sorry. You're technically correct. Lotus Notes is the crappiest of all.
Yes.
However, typically when you're in a Lotus Notes environment, it's 100% controlled. That's sort of the definition of Lotus Notes. So sort of being a startup and breaking into the Lotus Notes space is not going to happen. Lotus Notes used by like bankers and things and multinational companies that are doing evil things. So we should do, you guys use it here.
Not the Guardian anymore.
No. So in fact, yes, there are 100 million Lotus Notes users globally. Outlook is north of 500 million users. And in terms of time spent, Outlook is the largest application on the internet in the world. So no one spends more time in any application in the world other than, Facebook is getting like, don't know, 20 hours a day of a 19-year-old or something. Still doesn't beat Outlook, because your average, you know, vice president of something or other spends basically all their time in Outlook. So very fertile. However, Zobny, we are a young bunch of group. None of us, like the word Outlook and hiring, you know, we're pulling people out of Google and Yahoo. And we say, come to Zobny, work on Outlook. They're like, I'm sorry, what? First, we tell them what Outlook is, and then we tell them how popular it is, and they go like, how about that? So I would say that we'll move out of Outlook and into other sort of web-based email systems. Certainly, we would like to be on more platforms than Windows. And we're really excited about the mobile stuff. So we've recently launched our BlackBerry product. We did well with our Outlook product. We got all these like 4-star, 5-star ratings. The BlackBerry product came out and got almost basically 20 ratings of 5 stars or 4.5 stars right away. So we were thrilled. We'll do more mobile. And the other thing you'll see from Zobny, it's powerful in your inbox. It's much more powerful when it spans multiple inboxes. So collecting data from even 10-year-old inboxes is surprisingly, can you imagine? It's fascinating to look at your long tail of relationships, like people that you've met one time that seem like you never want to talk to them again. But then you're like, what was the name of that dude? That guy that sat across from me in that radio interview, what was that guy's name? And you'll have that information with Zobny. As inane as it might feel.
Well, you can parse your files at Zobny.com and tell us what your top tips are for managing your inbox on the Tech Weekly blog at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Mine, as I've said before, is Control-A-Delete. Thanks, Jeff. That's it for this week. Many thanks to our studio team, Jemima and Charles, and to our guest, Jeff from Zobny. Next week, we're speaking with corporate finance specialist Simon Carmichael, so don't forget to send in your questions for our startup surgery. The producer this week was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kurtowski. See you on the next Tech Weekly.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.